In 2019, the U.S. Congress representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and U.S. Senator Edward Markey put forward a resolution called the Green New Deal. Borrowing the name from Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal in the 1930s, a massive state-led plan to intervene in and save the economy from the 1929 crash, the Green New Deal proposes an even more ambitious state plan, this time to save the planet from climate change. The aim of a net zero carbon emissions economy within the next 30 years, the argument goes, can only be achieved by huge state intervention. The swift closing down of the oil and gas sectors of the economy will require the state to become the leader in investment planning and even the guarantor of jobs for everyone. But what assumptions about the economy, the nature of currency, and the role of financial institutions do we need to rethink in undertaking such a project? And what are the ethical challenges in giving the state unprecedented power over our future? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, Alex Douglas, lecturer in philosophy at the University of St. Andrews, author of The Philosophy of Debt, and co-director of the Future of Work and Income Research Network, talks to me about the philosophical questions that arise out of a project like the Green New Deal. So, Alex Douglas, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Alex, let's make clear what we're talking about. What is the Green New Deal?
The Green New Deal is, I mean, there are various versions of it, but it's a policy blueprint rather than a set of policies as such. There was a version that was proposed in 2019 by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the United States and Ed Markey, and there's a UK version. There are probably others, but it frames a different way of approaching climate change from the state's point of view. So most of the economic discussion of approaches to climate change is based on kind of nudges, incentives, you know, the role of the state is to use subsidies, taxes, things like that to incentivize a transformation in the economy. The Green New Deal is a more direct approach. That's the basic sense of it, is that the state is supposed to take control of the investment and direct the future course of the economy towards a sustainable future.
Yeah. So the Green New Deal, obviously, the name is a reference to the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's program for kind of restarting the American economy in the 1930s after the Great Depression. So can you tell us a little bit about what that was, what the New Deal was, and what its specific aims were, what methods of achieving them were employed, and so on?
Sure. The New Deal was a series or package of policies that the Roosevelt government brought in between 1933 and 39. This was in, as you say, the wake of the Great Depression. So, the overwhelming problem was unemployment. So a lot of the Green New Deal programs were employment programs of various sorts, things like the Civilian Conservation Corps, etc. You know, the Works Progress Administration, infrastructure projects, things to give people employment. There was also, I think there were three R's. So one R was relief for the unemployed. The other R was recovery of the economy. So this is supposed to be a kind of fiscal stimulus package. It was Roosevelt defying economic orthodoxy at the time and trying to spend his way out of a recession, you know, to simplify. But the third was regulation of the finance sector. And that's the thing that's not often, well, a bit less well known about the New Deal, is that in addition to putting people to work, building infrastructure, planting trees, etc., there was also this attempt to regain control of the financial system from the private interests who, in Roosevelt's view, and Roosevelt was, you know, somebody who was familiar with the financial system. He'd worked within it, he'd studied it, you know, to seize back control from the private interests who, in his view, had run the economy into the disaster of the 29 crash.
It's very interesting that that's an aspect of the program that is sort of not often thought about, and we'll come back to the elements of the Green New Deal that are more finance-based, which, you know, again, some people might think are a bit awkward or stand out from the rest of the program. But let's stay on the similarities or dissimilarities between the two projects for a little bit. So is this beyond branding? So is the Green New Deal called the Green New Deal for more than just kind of the positive associations perhaps that there exist about the New Deal and, you know, as you say, very powerful central government intervention in the economy, something that a lot of politicians shy away from these days and maybe sounds a little bit scary to a lot of people. So is there more than just branding similarities? Are the conditions of the economy, for example, comparable between 1930s America and, you know, 2021 America or Europe? And are the problems they are trying to solve comparable? Is the, you know, for example, the urgency of the problems comparable?
I think it's important that this term, the Green New Deal, comes into circulation after the 2008 financial crisis. So at that time, the reference was, yeah, directly back to the New Deal, that, okay, well, you've had a financial crisis, you have a resulting recession, we need a fiscal stimulus, we need an employment program, why not use the opportunity to try to decarbonize the economy? So I think that's what, you know, green candidates around 2010 in the US were starting to say, people like Jill Stein, the term was circulating then. But the proposals that have come out recently, the more sort of detailed Green New Deal proposals, I guess we are looking at a very different situation. So we're not coming out of a fine. Well, came out before COVID. I mean, maybe now the similarity has re-emerged. I mean, the thing that's different, very significantly different, is that Roosevelt was facing at 1.25% unemployment. He just had, you know, enormous slack, spare capacity in the economy, and a desperate need to give jobs to people directly, that the economy wasn't doing it on its own. And now we don't have that situation. You know, historians, economists disagree about this, but I think most economists agree that most of the famous New Deal packages were not what brought the American economy out of recession. The parts that did seem to make a difference were the things on the monetary side, the monetary innovations, you know, Roosevelt revaluing against the gold standard and things like this. You know, the actual employment things, although they made a difference to some people's lives, they weren't anti-recessionary measures, you know, as such. They weren't really successful as a fiscal stimulus, but, you know, they had many other benefits. So I guess you could say the Green New Deal is looking at what good did come out of the New Deal and trying to exploit related policies for the same effects.
So, okay, I'll keep this to one side and maybe we'll come back to that question about the amount of slack, as you say, in the economy, because the Green New Deal is obviously a very ambitious program, very expensive, and there's a big question about where it gets funded from. When, you know, we don't just have lots of people sitting around not working, although we will also revisit this question of unemployment and why we tolerate it. But can I ask you a sort of more provocative question in some ways, which is, what does philosophy have to contribute to the discussion around the Green New Deal? You know, a lot of the debates, the public debate that's taking place seems to focus along some, you know, lines of, well, is this affordable? Is it not? Is it practical? Is it not? Does a technology exist yet that would enable something like the Green New Deal to actually happen? Will it become available in time and so on? So shouldn't we just leave all this to, you know, the economists and the public policy wonks to figure out what's philosophy got to do with it?
Right. Well, two separate questions there, I guess. I'll take the second question first. So should we leave it to the economists and policy wonks? You know, I mean, my instinct is, God help us, if we leave anything of this sort to the economists and the policy. You know, I mean, my friends are economists.
Some of my best friends are economists. And
some of us are, yeah, exactly. I've nothing against economists. I'm friends with them. But they, I mean, you know, some of them are asking for advice from people, because economists, you know, as I said, I'm friends with many, but my feeling is that they're a little bit like artificial intelligence. If you give them a very well-defined problem, they can solve it for you efficiently. But if you let them try to define the problem for you, you know, well, you have to watch very carefully what the result's going to be. So because this is a problem of a scale and of a type that we've never really encountered before, it's so global, the magnitude is, you know, so beyond measure. You know, you need people who are able to think about how to frame the problem itself. Philosophers, you know, are better at making problems than solving them, but this is a case where I think, you know, formulating the problem is crucial.
Asking the right questions.
Asking the right questions, yeah. I mean, the other thing I would say is if you think of the analogy invited by the Green New Deal, you know, when Roosevelt set up the original New Deal, he was taking advice from economists who were very much outside of the mainstream. You know, the orthodox position remained the standard view that, you know, what was needed was austerity, liquidation of stocks, capital, etc. Just wasn't working. So once you're stepping outside of the mainstream view in any scientific discipline, you're asking philosophical questions, you know, the questions, well, then if the mainstream economists have this wrong, and I know there's debate about whether or not they did, but, you know, I think most economists would admit that the mainstream had something wrong, then the question is, well, who might have this right and why? What's the methodological blockage that's prevented the mainstream from seeing this? Should we look to the institutional economists? Should we look to other heterodox schools? So, you know, I think philosophy can help there. You know, I'm a believer in what Eric Schlieser calls synthetic philosophy. I don't think philosophers have a special sort of domain of expertise that they can work out all on their own. I think you need factual content to philosophize, and so you need to kind of get your hands dirty in lots of disciplines. You need to consult experts and have a go at working through economic models.
Yeah.
Devastating as that is.
Fun work, yeah. That sounds right. I was obviously playing sort of devil's advocate to some extent. So I agree with you. Obviously, part of the framework of the Green New Deal is the idea that we have to question some of the presuppositions about the way we've been living our lives so far, at least in the developed world, but also, you know, presuppositions about the economy and about how we think about the economy, which is through economics, right? So is the way in which we think about economics at the moment correct, or what are the presuppositions that we might question? And that's obviously one of the things that philosophy is good at, questioning assumptions about how we do things, about our lives, or about various other disciplines. What do you think is the biggest presupposition, or maybe a set of presuppositions that we have been taking for granted without really questioning, but that the Green New Deal sort of is forcing us to examine?
That's a good question. Well, one thing, you know, I made some tongue-in-cheek disparaging comments about economists getting us into this mess. You know, to a certain extent, I think philosophers have to take credit for getting us into this situation as well, because, you know, political thinking, economic thinking from the early modern period onwards has kind of gravitated around this liberal consensus, this idea that the state has to be neutral on questions of value. And this feeds in, you know, in so many ways into different institutions. There's this idea of market neutrality for central banks, that central banks as state institutions are allowed to sort of try to control the amount of investment that's going on, but they're not allowed to choose what we're investing in. You know, that has to be left to individuals to decide. And so, we've basically fortified our institutions against the possibility of something like the Green New Deal, because we've put all of these restrictions in place that prevent the state from doing what it would have to do in the Green New Deal, which is make a long-term plan for the economy. So that sounds scary to people.
Why do you think that is? Why do we recoil at the idea of centralized government planning? I guess since you mentioned that there is this kind of background liberal consensus, I guess one worry is always, you know, well, the government getting it wrong, but also no one should yield that amount of power. You know, no one should be able to basically plan the future to such a detail, because, you know, that seems like too much power for anyone to have. But what do you think the diagnosis is? Why do we find that that idea of central planning so slightly alien and slightly scary.
Yeah, well, I mean, as my kind of piece of amateur sociology, there's a lot of history here, of course. So during the Cold War, there was all this rhetoric that developed around this imagined opposition. I'll explain why I think it's imagined in a sec, but this imagined opposition between a liberal free market society where individual decisions are sort of aggregated through the market mechanism into an overall result, and this top-down central, you know, state planning mechanism, and obviously
associated with the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean,
fall of communism and all the rest of it.
Yeah, with a lot of terrible regimes. So, you know, I mean, I think when you talked about the New Deal as a branding strategy, I guess part of the point there is to make people look at the right historical example. It's like, you know, we're talking about basically increasing the amount of state intervention in the economy for the state taking a planning role, but look at the example of Roosevelt. Don't look at the example of, you know, that's why it's not called the Green 5-Year Plan or something like that.
Yeah, it's been done before in a capitalist society and it worked out fine. It worked out well. We look at it with some nostalgia, almost, as it were. You know, we don't look at it as kind of a terrible thing that happened. Yeah.
Well, some do. Yeah, some do and some don't, of course. But, you know, I mean, I think that really to win the argument, the thing that fundamentally needs to be brought into the discussion, which I don't think has been brought out clearly enough, is markets can't plan. They're you know, structurally incapable of planning. I mean, there are things like futures markets and forwards markets, but those are people now allocating the resources of the future among each other. But future generations don't send any market signals, and poor people don't send any market signals, and people who are going to be subject to the externalities of one government's decision but live in a different country don't send any market, you know. So there are all these reasons that planning is just not something that a market can do. And I think what people think is, okay, well, when you don't have the state planning, you have this unplanned economy, you know, this free enterprise system. But it's just not true. I mean, planning is every economy is planned. Planning is something that an advanced economy can't do without. When any time you have a technologically advanced, you know, some technologically complex products, it's decades between conceiving and actually rolling them out onto the market. So you need a tremendous amount of planning to be able to do that. So when the economy is not planned by the state, it's being planned by somebody else. And, you know, in our case, it's being planned by the financial system, by the combination of central banks, the banking system, big players in the financial markets. So, you know, if you think about it that way, then this debate about...
So there is someone planning it, but it's not the state, and it's someone that isn't accountable to us in the same way that governments are and so on. So they're not, you know, the markets aren't democratically accountable in the same way. Wouldn't an objection be something like, well, you mentioned, for example, a technological product being developed and there's a lot of planning going into it. But of course, that's one very small, tiny part of the economy. No one company plans for the entire, you know, US economy. They might plan for when to launch, you know, the iPhone, or when to launch a new car or something like that. So isn't the planning at a much, much smaller scale?
Mm-hmm. Right. So this is something that, John Kenneth Galbraith published this book in the 60s called The New Industrial State, where he made this argument that I've just made roughly about planning, that the modern economy requires a planning system. And his view was that these big monopolistic corporations do a lot of the planning. And so I think a lot of economists think, well, that hasn't really worked out as a theory, because large corporations are much less dominant now than they were in Galbraith. I mean, there are some very notable examples. If you need to order something online or use a taxi service, I'm sure some examples of fairly large corporations will come to mind.
Some names jump to mind, yeah.
But the economic ecosystem is much more diversified than it used to be. But there are other things that people don't look at within the financial system. So this is why, I mean, I think you're going to ask later about the connection between finance and the problem of climate change. It's not an obvious connection. But for example, collateral frameworks, I mean, to me, those are basically planning bodies. So a central bank decides on its collateral framework, which means it decides which sorts of loans a bank can repo through and get cash for, which means it's massively incentivizing. It suddenly, you know, if you're a bank, if you can make a certain type of loan and then repo that loan through the Bank of England, that loan has suddenly become 100% safe. You can just swap it for cash. But all of this is planned. None of this is to do with the market, right? These are all decisions made by a committee of people who most of us couldn't name, none of us elected. The idea that that even could be neutral is something that, you know, has been challenged by people.
Okay, let's kind of wrap that bit up by saying a little bit more about, first of all, what is the idea of the liberal sort of consensus of neutrality? Can we just like briefly say what that is and what the motivation is? And I guess your argument is that's not true. So not it's a bad idea necessarily, but even by its own standards, as it were, that liberal paradigm isn't fulfilling its promise. It's not really building institutions, government institutions that are neutral. It's building government institutions that have certain inherent biases about what's good and what's not good, what's a policy to proceed with, what's a policy not to proceed with. So what was that liberal sort of idea about neutrality? Can we just say a few things about it?
I mean, maybe an example would be, I think when somebody like, who's I reading, Steven Pinker, I think, was defending the idea of a carbon tax as a liberal approach to the climate change problem. He said, you know, if you impose a carbon tax, then all you're doing is you're setting a target. You're saying, okay, we think the price of carbon in general needs to go up this much to move towards our zero emissions target, and you're letting the consumer and the producer decide how they want to make the savings. So suddenly the price of all your carbon-intensive things can go up, but, you know, it's your choice. You could drive your car less, you could, you know, take fewer flights, you can buy
fewer things, yeah.
Greener energy, you know, so that, you know, that sounds nice and that sounds neutral. And so we're setting one goal, but we're leaving it up to individuals to decide. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's the kind of ideal.
And why isn't that neutral in practice?
Well, I think you've seen, I mean, the I think countries are now very, very scared of carbon taxes because, first of all, a carbon tax is non-progressive. So the Gilets Jaunes in France had all these issues.
Yeah, it ends up affecting disproportionately the poor rather than, yeah.
It ends up, yeah, affecting the poor disproportionately. So it's only neutral. It's only neutral if you define neutrality in a particular way. But of course, yeah, it's not neutral in terms of the differential effect that it has on the poor. It's not neutral in terms of charging consumers rather than producers. But more to the point, you're not giving people alternatives. So Anne Pettifor says this about carbon taxes, that the congestion charge in London is another example. Livingston brought in the congestion charge. There was a lot of opposition to it. You know, it was opposed by, with all the same arguments that the Gilets Jaunes use about the carbon tax. But Livingstone also invested in an alternative infrastructure. You know, he provided the option of taking the bus instead. So that's the kind of a difference. So I guess the Green New Deal is built around the idea that if you provide, as a government, if you provide green energy and then you charge people for buying carbon-intensive, non-renewable energy, that's different. But if you just start charging people for using energy and then asking them to make these sacrifices, you're sort of exploiting the this very vaguely defined idea of liberal neutrality.
And of course, the outcomes, as I talked with Tom Brooks in the previous episode, in an international context, are also not neutral because, of course, richer countries can pay a little bit more to drive their cars and fly around the world and so on. But, you know, poorer countries will then have less access to energy, essentially. And in their case, energy to meet very, very basic needs like, you know, having electricity and light in their homes or having sanitation and things like that will become even more unaffordable to them than they already are. Let me ask you a question about the Green New Deal, which, you know, seems a little bit jarring when you first read it. So by looking at the official web page of the Green New Deal, the UK one, we find the following statement. It says something like, "The Green New Deal is a practical plan for tackling the interlinked crisis of climate and ecological emergencies driven by an economy that isn't working for the majority and is causing corrosive inequality and a finance system that serves only an elite few." So the Green New Deal presents these two crises, a kind of ecological crisis with a financial economic crisis as interlinked. And it's not obvious to begin with why this second part about inequality and an elite-serving finance system has anything to do with climate change. So why is this part of the Green New Deal? And, you know, and the criticism is obviously, well, progressives just like shove in other kind of policies they like into this thing, which otherwise has nothing to do with, you know, climate and climate change.
Yeah, yeah, that's the kind of criticism. You know, one of the senators opposing the Green New Deal bill that Ocasio-Cortez brought in said, you know, this is just a bill of everything that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wants the government to do.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, I mean, you know, yeah. I think that is something worth thinking about, probably not for philosophers, but for, you know, for people who work in the business of politics. But there is an argument to be made that if you're doing something on the scale of what it would really take to move to a net zero emitting economy, you need an enormous consensus behind you. Right. So unless you want this to be like the Soviet model, the only time that states can get away with taking actions on this scale is when they have a significant unmoving democratic consensus, you know, relatively robust democratic consensus behind them. And so anything that smacks of unfairness is going to break that consensus. And again, you can use the example of the carbon tax, you know, Macron's carbon tax. It's just you lose the consensus because it's not that people aren't willing to make sacrifices, but they're not willing to make them when they feel like other people aren't paying their share, their fair share. So that's why I guess, you know, you can't separate out the question of mitigating climate change from the question of dealing with structural systematic injustices, at least perceived injustices, because you need to carry the nation with you to be able to do something on this scale.
You're listening to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This episode is part of our mini-series on philosophers thinking about climate change. You're right, there's a very pragmatic sort of issue of getting people behind this project, and as you say, there has to be a sense of fairness for the prices that will have to be paid. But I mean, obviously, you know, because these policy proposals are so radical, and by radical, I don't mean extreme, I mean in the original sense of the word, which is tackling kind of the roots of our system and kind of upending those roots, or, you know, trying to find new foundations for a system. There's going to be a huge impact on the economy and on jobs that are linked to, you know, carbon emissions, a devastating impact, you might say, on, you know, the oil and gas industry, anyone working in the car manufacturing industry that still makes internal combustion engines, which I imagine are most of them, anyone working in steel and the manufacturing of cement. I didn't know that manufacturing cement and steel results in quite a big carbon dioxide footprint. So all these industries will have to either shut down or we're going to have to find ways of technological innovations that will allow us to, you know, continue making these materials without emitting carbon. And so the idea, I guess, is that, you know, we need to prevent mass unemployment on a level that has never been seen before. So it's not only getting people on board preemptively, it's also to prevent, you know, mass misery as a result of implementing these proposals. So there are a number of solutions put forward to mitigate the effects of environmental regulations that would, you know, radically change the way the planet produces energy and consumes energy. What do you think the right kinds of proposals in that direction are? And do you think it's possible to do this in the framework that we have, which is around 30 years, I believe, is the current one, aiming for net zero?
30 years to net zero is the optimistic one. And yeah, the IPCC thinks maybe less than that, 20. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the heart of the issue. You know, there are two times that the emissions have come down globally in recent history. One is just after 2008, and the other is, you know, over the last couple of years. You know, why is that? Well, we know why. It's less economic activity. So at the moment, at our current technological level, it seems like reduction in emissions means reduction of economic activity, which means, of course, as you say, losses of jobs, etc. even if you have technological changes. So, yeah, you mentioned steel production, so you need a reductant to convert iron ore into steel. Right now we use coal gas for that. Let's say we could switch to clean hydrogen. Well, I mean, I don't know the technical details, but if you're a safety inspector in, a steel plant based on the old technology, who knows whether you have the expertise to keep being a safety inspector in one that's using hydrogen, clean hydrogen, maybe everything changes. Of course, there'll be loads and loads of changes like this. I mean, even if we reduce our emissions, there's then the question of how we're going to get all the carbon out of the atmosphere. Drawdown is obviously going to be a huge bit. And that's just the total unknown variable in this equation. We just don't have a drawdown technology. We don't know what the drawdown technology will be. People have various ideas. Maybe it's about using the deep ocean. But so we don't know what skills are going to be needed for that. We don't know how many jobs that's going to create. So the reason there's a job guarantee built into the Green New Deal, this was another thing that people were like, aren't you just trying to put two things together that you like into a single proposal? Well, no, not at all. I mean, the only way you're going to make this contract with the people, that's what the New Deal was, right? FDR said he was making a contract with the American people. The only way states are going to be able to make contracts with their citizens to do something like this when there are so many unknowns. We just have no idea what is to put in place guarantees, to tell people, well, we're going to be able to look after you no matter what happens, as best we can.
So let's focus a little bit on this idea of jobs guarantees, because this is part of a new project that you've embarked on, the future of work and income. And you've written a piece where you mentioned that Boris Johnson has kind of hijacked that idea to some extent to propose something slightly different, what he calls an opportunity guarantee.
Handful of apprentices.
Apprentices, yeah, and training opportunities. So what is the idea behind a jobs guarantee? Is it about the government making sure they will offer you a job if you want one? Is it making sure the private sector will have the jobs open for people to, apply for? How does that work?
Most of the sort of proponents of job guarantees in the US use the phrase federally funded, locally administered. So I think the idea is that you have a central funding mechanism which guarantees financing for creating living wage jobs to anyone who wants one, and then you outsource the administration to NGOs, charities, local governments, etc. The idea is supposed to be that if you include enough players, you should have the infrastructure there to be able to find something for everyone to do. Then the only problem is right, coming up with the money to pay them, and the central government's supposed to take care of that.
And I mean, this is obviously a huge rethinking, a huge reassessment of how we think of unemployment, right? And this is one of the other things that you've written about. At the moment, it seems that we more or less take it for granted that no matter how good the economy is, there will always be a little bit of unemployment. And even if the percentages sound low, you might say, the unemployment rates are only 2% or only 3%. That's still hundreds of thousands of people each time. And, people who are often also permanently trapped in unemployment, because as you mentioned in a piece you wrote on this, I'll put the link in the show notes, about how unemployment breeds unemployment, right? Once you're unemployed for a bit, you seem less attractive to future employers, and then, the circle kind of continues. Why does our current economic system always produce unemployed people, and how is it possible to switch to one where that doesn't happen, especially if we're, going to make lots of jobs that exist today go away?
Well, I think that the macroeconomic orthodoxy on this, which I think has been recently challenged just by the data. So, big name macroeconomists have come out and said, well, we're no longer sure about this. That's just very recently. But it used to be that there was something called the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. The idea was, in a perfect, frictionless, completely efficient world, There would be no unemployment because the labour market would just clear, like markets are supposed to do. And everybody who wanted work at a given wage would be able to find it. So the reason that doesn't happen is because there are various frictions in the market, and so the not quite market equilibrium, but the stable point ends up being not zero unemployment, but maybe 3-4%. So the proponents of the job guarantee say the government is paying for the unemployment already. Barring some very tragic cases, people in the UK don't starve to death when they're unemployed. You know, they're in some way provided with, somehow they're getting enough income to live on. So it doesn't make any sense, right? It just doesn't seem to make any sense that you could pay for people to do nothing, to go on lots of job training courses, you know, to do all the things that they do. In the US, a lot of them go to prison, right? That's how they deal with the problem. So, well, that's really expensive. It's very expensive. It would be much cheaper to just pay someone a living wage and to put them in prison. Well, you know, so it must be possible. That's the reasoning. It must be possible to use the resources that you're currently spending on unemployment insurance benefits, all the costs, you know, the social costs of unemployment, the health costs, costs in crime, you know, all the things that we know it leads to. It must be possible to use that to employ at least some of these people instead.
So another idea that hasn't come out exactly out of the Green New Deal, but is one that is often at play in this discussion, is that of the universal basic income, right? And it was even played a minor role in the U.S. presidential election of 2020. So would that be a solution to mass unemployment as a result of drastic climate regulations? How is it different from a jobs guarantee? How does this fit in, as it were? Is this just an alternative? Is it just a similar proposal, just under a different banner? How does it affect the way we think about the fundamentals of how our economy is run if we look into something like a UBI?
Yeah, that's a good question. One thing I can say philosophically is, to me, the universal basic income is attached to the idea of liberal neutrality, which, you know, I've earlier said it is kind of an obstruction in the way of Green New Deal type thinking. Basically, the thing about a job guarantee is that the state has an active role in planning. It has to think, okay, what are we going to do with people? And I sort of feel like, you know, that can be the state's responsibility. The universal basic income leaves it up to the individual. It's like, look, here's some money, you know, here's subsistence. You go and find, you know, how you want to contribute usefully, which again, you know, sounds nicer. I think on the face of it, these sort of liberal versions always sound nicer. But you've given up a lot of planning power, I mean, as the state official, in doing that. Maybe that's as much as I'll say on that question.
As always, this podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. Check out The Philosopher's website for upcoming events in April, including a conversation with comedian Josie Long and writer Tom Wyman about his book, Infinitely Full of Hope, an attempt to answer Kant's question, what can I hope for, in a world that increasingly seems on the verge of destruction? So let me press you a little bit on the state, because you're very keen on this kind of centralized state planning. Let me press you a little bit on that. So we all know that well-meaning, well-intending policies often have catastrophic unintended consequences. What makes you think that the state has the ability to centrally plan the jobs of everyone in the economy without making a massive blunder and leading to some kind of unthought of disaster, especially given, I'll say this as an aside, if we already think that someone is planning the economy, it's just not the state, it's you know, finance institutions. I mean, clearly that's not going perfectly well either, right? I mean, so maybe the idea of any central planning is just problematic.
Well, I mean, the honest answer to your question, how do I know, is I don't, you know, blind and desperate hope, I think, because I can't see how you could move from putting out billions of tons of CO2 to putting out net zero without an awful lot of planning happening. I can't see how that would happen. So, but you know, I mean, what you say is right. You know, people who have kind of socialist instincts who say, oh, you know, we should nationalize the rails, you know, they're usually the same people who, when you say, oh, so you want Boris Johnson in charge of the railways, they say, God, no, no. Like, so, well, I mean, right. You don't get to choose who the central planners are.
Yeah, if people vote that person. Yeah, he's
I mean, I think that, you know, there's this idea that we've had from Smith onwards that if you can have a system that's based on self-interest, it's going to be more robust and reliable. So, you know, isn't it lucky that I don't have to depend on the benevolence of the butcher, the baker, and the brewer for my dinner? Isn't it great that, you know, their self-interest will do that? And this is a case where we really 100% do seem to just depend on benevolence. You know, we need you need to hope that somehow the political process will put in power people both willing and capable of bringing about this treatment. But, I mean, it would be an unprecedented human achievement. And as I say, we built all our institutions basically to work against that.
Do we have to think of it as benevolence? Can't we think of it? I mean, in some ways, we're still going to be acting in self-interest, because obviously if we don't do all this and the climate change does get totally out of control, it's not going to be a very nice place to live. the planet Earth is not going to be a very nice place to live on anymore. So I know, of course, you know, maybe the consequences are a bit further down the road, and maybe most of the politicians alive today won't, you know, face them. But I don't believe the kind of, you know, Greta Thunberg line that they don't really care about their children or their grandchildren. I think everyone, you know, more or less does care about those things. So isn't it still a question of self-interest rather than benevolence?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's really hard to say. An important thing that I read that I hadn't really thought of before was from John Broome, who said, you know, this is not social dilemma, what, you know, game theorists call a social dilemma is like a prisoner's dilemma, where if one person does the altruistic thing unilaterally, they actually pay a cost for that. Yeah. Whereas, you know, it's only if everyone does it together that we get a gain from it. It's not like that. You know, if one country reduces its emissions, it does, you know, to that extent mitigate warming. It, of course, benefits everybody else as well. And so you do have this problem that, you know, people can just sort of selfishly wait for someone else to take on the burden. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, it isn't as bad as it could be. Imagine if there were a problem on a global scale that were a social dilemma.
Yeah, of course. Unfortunately, that is the way that a lot of countries think about it, isn't it? That, you know, they don't want to damage their economy unless everyone else does the same. So even if it shouldn't be a social dilemma, sadly, it's probably thought of that way.
Yeah. Again, when you ask why shouldn't we leave this to economy, I think sometimes, you know, the kind of rational choicey way of thinking about this is probably misguided, because, as you say, I mean, the standard self-interested like agents in economic models wouldn't have done this, right? We wouldn't have got here. If you own a natural resource, your self-interest would make you use it sustainably, because you get a small return over an infinite number of years instead of a large return over a finite number of years. I mean, there's no contest. But what does happen? Well, again, this is why I think it's really important to acknowledge that we've planned our way into this problem. We haven't bungled our way into it. You know, why does someone who uses a natural resource, why do people who own forests in Indonesia strip the forests and flog them all off instead of maintaining them? Well, partly because they've taken out loans from banks who charge them an interest rate that can't be sustained at, you know, a sustainable level. The interest rate is just in excess of the interest rate of the natural interest rate of the resource. So, you know, or why have the banks done that? Well, you know, all sorts of reasons, but not rational. Nothing that you can explain with a rational choice model. There's something else going on.
I mean, obviously, a framework usually applied to explain that is short-termism, right? So you're pursuing your self-interest in the short run, but not in the longer run. And there's a lot written, obviously, about how in recent years that's the main incentive given to financial institutions and banks and so on, which, you know, arguably led to the financial crisis and all that jazz. Since we're talking about finance and since we're circling this question of how much all of this is going to cost, let's come to that question. The question is often, how are governments around the world going to fund the Green New Deal? How are they going to be able to pay their citizens a universal basic income or promise to give everyone a job? And also, how are they going to do all these things whilst at the same time, you know, shutting down large parts of the economy and also investing in the developments of new technologies necessary for implementing the Green New Deal? And the usual answer is debt in some way, right? Another subject matter that you've written a lot about. So we have seen that during COVID, governments are prepared to borrow enormous amounts of money from themselves, essentially, and that's something I'd like to come back to, in order to address an emergency. And so the question is, can the Green New Deal be funded in the same way that we fund?
Right. The short answer, I think, is yes, at least hopefully. But, you know, these are very big numbers. The numbers that were coming out of the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez proposal were on the order of taking half the entire US government budget and adding it again. But I think, you know, if you threw UBI in, which by the way isn't part of the Green New Deal proposal, that would be enormous again. Job guarantee is, you know, much less than paying every single person a kind of significant basic income. So, you know, that's something to think about. But the funding mechanism would be on the order of an investment, because this is, after all, you know, an investment in decarbonizing the future. The whole idea is that the state takes over the role of investing in the right technologies, the right infrastructure, the right research and development to move towards a zero net emissions economy. The thought behind the Green New Deal is that the private, you know, or semi-private agents who are currently responsible for directing investment aren't doing that. So yes, I mean, a lot of it would be debt. A lot of it would be spending that isn't financed from tax revenues directly. The idea is that you wait to collect the tax revenues until the stuff has actually started happening.
Mm. Okay, let's then revisit this question of government debt. And as we said, the way that most of it is financed at the moment in response to COVID is governments borrowing money from their own central banks. And my question is this a viable practice in the long term? Is there no limit to how much money governments can borrow from themselves? Surely there has to be some kind of limit to how much governments can do that. What is that limit?
Right. So this is where, you know, when you asked earlier about what philosophy can contribute, I think this is where we really need to start thinking philosophically about what a currency is, you know, what it is to have a sovereign currency. So yeah, we are in this weird situation right now where, although governments aren't legally allowed to borrow directly from their central banks, de facto that's what's happening, because the primary deal is lend to the government and they borrow from the central bank, you know, immediately to cover those loans. And central banks are running near zero interest rates. Of course, economists have a lot to say about how long that can go on for. I'm basically a Chartist, you know. I have this understanding of a sovereign currency that people like Warren Mosler explain very well. That, look, you know, what is a currency fundamentally? When we say, when the government spends money, where does it get the money from? You might say, well, it taxes it, borrows it from its citizens. Okay, well, where do they get the money from? You know, they're not allowed to print it themselves. That's counterfeiting. So really, it's a state. It's a state-sponsored institution. It's a state-created institution. Well, how does it work? Moses' explanation is a sovereign currency is a device for the state. You know, first and foremost, it gets used in all sorts of other ways, of course, but first and foremost, it's a device by which the state provisions the public sector. So you do it like this, you know, suppose I want someone to mow the lawn in a public park. If I just tell you, go mow the lawn in the public park, you won't listen to me. If I'm a dictator, maybe I can force you to do it. But if I control a sovereign currency, what I can do is this. I can say, look, I estimate your property at this value. You therefore owe this much tax on that property, and you can only pay that tax in a currency that I issue. So now you have to do something to get the currency I issue, and I get to decide what that is. I say, okay, well, I'll pay you this much per hour to go and mow the lawn in this park in my currency. Nobody else can make it. I don't have to tax you directly. Maybe I tax your neighbor, and now you'll work for the currency because you know you can trade it with your neighbor for things that are valuable, etc. But, you know, ultimately, fundamentally, the currency can be thought of as a state provisioning device. And so the Green New Deal is just a way of actively using that instrument, the currency, as an instrument for state provisioning. So, okay, we need to provision the economy with everything that's necessary to move to net zero emissions. So this is how we'll do it. But the fundamental point here is that the currency has value because of the need to pay taxes in that currency. So that means you need a very solid tax base. That's why the issues of fairness, of economic inequality, all of these things are thrown into the Green New Deal, because it's fundamentally linked together. If you're using the currency in the way that I've described as a kind of state provisioning instrument, you need to be willing to collect taxes in that currency, which means you need to think about who you should be taxing, how you should be doing it, where you're getting your tax base from, what sort of legal framework you have in place to enforce the taxes, all of that. So a Green New Deal has to involve a long-term tax plan as well.
So, okay, so let's get to the second part of that question, which is the limiting principle of how much a government can do this. Because you said, okay, it's a sovereign currency and the state can basically choose to use it in whatever way it sees fit. But of course, sovereign states don't exist in a vacuum. They exist in an interconnected finance world. And as we've seen in the past, when the financial markets lose confidence in a currency, that currency plummets in value, and you know what you can purchase with that currency, also drops. And so, you know, given that most countries import lots of goods from other places around the world, those countries then end up being a lot poorer than they were beforehand. So, what is the limit to this? When can we say, okay, you can't keep doing this after, you know, this point or that point? What would be the limiting principles?
I suppose the limiting principle is when the government loses control of its ability to tax in its currency at, an appropriate rate to underwrite demand for that currency. So, you know, with cases of serious hyperinflation, Weimar Germany, Zimbabwe, places like, you know, these are places where, for various reasons, you have either an unwillingness or an inability of the state to properly tax, to have a solid tax base. So, in other words, you're throwing out lots of money, but there's very little demand for it because the tax base is so small. If you go back to our, you know, this little example, if I say you owe me one Alex Douglas dollar, and I'm, you know, printing thousands of them, well, you know, these things are going to be of very little value to you. Or to whoever I'm paying them to. But of course, you know, there's also this issue that people also want currency to just hang on to. You know, not all of the currency immediately gets circulated back into the state. Of course, people save it. But, you know, savings can be very dangerous. If a country is importing a lot, net importing a lot, that means it's basically pumping out lots of its currency into savings accounts held by foreign citizens. What are they holding onto the currency for? What are they going to do with it? If at some point they're all going to come, you know, rushing in with their currency to make purchases back in the original country, then, you know, you'll drive an inflationary crisis. That kind of thing can drive people's confidence in the currency out the window.
And when does that happen? When does that confidence gets lost usually? There must be some patterns from history that we can think about. So when does that usually happen?
Right. I mean, it's such a complicated and deep historical question. It depends so much on the country. You know, one thing that Ann Pettifor talks about in her book on the Green New Deal is the United States is in a very different position because it prints, issues the world's reserve currency. And that was set up very deliberate. I mean, you know, it's a very contingent thing about what happened coming out of the Bretton Woods Agreement. Keynes wanted the world to use this neutral currency that was issued by an international neutral authority. The United States overruled that and said, no, we're going to have international trade conducted in our currency. So the US can get away with running very big deficits for a very long time because, you know, people need US dollars. For other countries, yeah, it's a factor of many other things. And the role of central banks, you know, independent central banks, basically it was decided in the 70s that governments are not responsible, are not guaranteed to be responsible in their use of the currency issuing power. So central banks were given this independent authority to control this using the interest rate.
And why was that? Why did that decoupling happen between central banks and governments?
That's a very good question as well. There were, you know, empirically, it happened during a time when very powerful countries were experiencing inflationary crises. People debate about whether that was the factor or not. So, you know, I mean, it just so happens that in the late 70s. But of course, you know, that wasn't obviously caused by irresponsible spending on the part of governments. There were lots of factors. There were, you know, the power structure with the unions. There was the oil, oil-based economy. And at that point in time, the oil was being sold by a cartel, which was jacking up the price for all sorts of geopolitical reasons. At the same time, there were theoretical arguments, very abstract arguments being made by economists to show, you know, using these little game theory, rational choice type models, that a government is kind of caught in a trap where it's going to be time inconsistent. It's basically subject to short-termism. Governments are just incentivized to be short-termist.
The next electoral cycle.
Yeah, exactly. Spend big now, get the votes, and let the next electoral cycle deal with the inflationary consequences. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which makes sense in theory, but whether it's borne out in practice is a different question. Mm.
Yeah. So there is still a worry, of course, that if governments do end up borrowing more than they ever have borrowed from their central banks, the worries of the 70s will come true, and namely there will be hyperinflation.
Yeah.
Many, many countries that try that out.
Yeah, and in a way it's maybe even worse than that, because personally I'm not a strong believer in the power of independent central banks. I think that, you know, there's really a limit to how much a central bank can do by jiggling around this one base rate. So really, if a government wants to maintain faith in its currency, it's going to have to set up a proper tax system, as I say. Unfortunately, that's, you know, political dynamite.
So are you saying that in the end, some of that funding will have to come from taxes, not just from debt?
Yeah. I think that, you know, tax is what ultimately controls inflation. People think, okay, well, you know, if there's a bit of inflationary pressure, the central bank can maybe raise the interest rate. That, among other things, constrains the government's spending, because governments, you know, then see their debt projected to explode. So they'll, you know, ideally they'll wind it in. Although that doesn't seem to really happen. But in the end, I think proper inflationary controls involve taxing excess demand out of the system and regulating the kinds of investments and spending that people can do. So you need a banking system that doesn't let people go on spending sprees, mm-hmm. you know, chase asset bubbles, things like that. You need a tax system that properly restricts people's disposable income.
So, I mean, all that will sound quite alarming potentially to a lot of people, because it's giving the government a lot more power over our economy and over our our personal spending habits and all the rest of it. What would you say is the key ethical challenge that arises out of a project like the Green New Deal and out of a project that is going to be so centralized and give so much power to a central unitary institution?
Well, I think what we need to do is break out of the paradigm that we've been looking at the world, because people have grown used to thinking that planning is something that the government does and liberty is something that the market provides. So I think we need to rethink these concepts, because when you say, you know, it's going to be alarming to people, I suppose they think so because they think right now, you know, we have a free market that isn't planned and you're talking about bringing in something that is planned. Well, again, I just have to come back to the point. No, I mean, right now, decisions rationing credit, rationing investment, what gets produced tomorrow, all of these decisions are made basically by a small cartel of private banks, of financial institutions, who are not answerable to market pressures or political pressures. So I think that if we can reframe the problem in that way, then maybe we can change the political discussion.
I take your point that this requires a sort of shift in the way that we think about the economy and how we think of what the economy is now. But do you see any dangers to the shift taking place? Is it going to be all kind of nice and rosy, and you know, everyone's going to be a lot happier and richer and healthier? Or does this shift also involve any challenges and dangers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the other challenge is we have to listen very carefully. I think the issue has become so polarized and ideological, it's very tempting for people like me who are on the side of advocating for big decisive action on climate change mitigation to dismiss people who have concerns about this as conspiracy theorists. And of course, I mean, there are conspiracy theorists. There are people who say global warming is just a conspiracy. It's just the government's way of trying to seize more power. But of course, there are legitimate concerns. I mean, anytime you're giving power to politicians, unfortunately, politicians are at an all-time low in terms of levels of public trust. So this is the worst time in the world to depend on them. And yet, I don't see who else we could depend on. I mean, the alternative to me is to depend on the finance sector. And so far, that hasn't worked. But, you know, I think that the philosophical thing that we need to think about is our notions of authority and planning and sovereignty. To some extent, maybe liberalism has stopped us having to think about these questions. But, I mean, philosophically, it seems quite weird. If you ask a person on the street, do you think it's better, because the democratically elected politicians can't be trusted, do you think it's better to have an appointed czar from within the finance sector in control of the level of investment in our nation, in control of, you know, just a committee of kind of grey eminences who nobody knows about? I think most people would say no. And yet that somehow is the compromise that we've ended up with. I think just to a certain extent we've avoided thinking about these questions.
Mm. So yeah. So the Green New Deal is forcing us to rethink the current status quo and whether we are happy with it or whether we're fully aware of how things operate at the moment, let alone how they might operate in the future.
Mm-hmm. It might be because I'm a student of early modern political thinking. You know, I think there's just a kind of a lot of Hobbesian questions here that mm-hmm. who are we giving up our rights to? How do we choose and for what purpose? You know, mm-hmm. what's the trade-off? When is it worth giving up our rights to the extent that we can have a degree of central planning?
One last question on what would you recommend to listeners on the issues we've been talking about? What would you recommend to read? What book would you recommend on either the economics of the climate change or the future jobs in a kind of Green New Deal scenario?
The book that covers all the topics we've talked about today is Ann Pettifor's book, The Case for the Green New Deal. She sort of explains, I hope probably better than I have, a lot of the kind of financial technology side of it. She talks about universal basic income. She talks about job guarantees. She covers all of these issues. Of course, there's not much on the philosophical questions, you know, the ethical questions. On the ethical questions, I guess probably the classic is still John Broome's Climate Matters.
Alex Douglas, thank you very much.
Thank you.
To listen to future episodes of The Philosopher and the News, subscribe and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you enjoy this episode, please help us spread the word and leave us a review. Next week, I'll be talking to philosopher Sarah Conley about climate change and reproductive rights. Given our impact on the planet, is it ethical to have more than one child in the era of climate change? I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher and the News. Speak again next week.